Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Whoa, one act three times, and if you don't ever say yeah, you know where to find me. It's one bar tag, yeah, you know where to find me. It's one bar tag.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Born in Northeast Arkansas, Brad Williams was fed a heaping helping of bluegrass and country music. Brad now fronts the local honky-tonk giants, the Salty Dogs. The Salty Dogs music is available tonight after the show, as well as your favorite digital retail provider. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is in conjunction with the Argenta Arts District's The British Invasion 50 Years Later Photography Exhibit, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has played with Blind Mississippi Morris, who will be here on our show on May 20th for the Delta Music Show. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton. And the piece we're featuring, this piece right over here entitled The Fab Four, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our storytellers tell stories about how the Beatles invaded their lives, both in the past and in the present. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Anne Gordon Perry is on her way to the first Beatles show in the South in 1966. And we'll end the night with Jan Hamlett as a wrong turn almost crushes a decades-old dream. But let's start the night with Catherine Schultz and a rumor about the Fab Four that might just change everything in Missing the Mop Tops.
It was September 1964, and my date and I were watching a drive-in movie just across the line in Missouri, 17 miles from my home in Cherokee Village, Arkansas. The rapping on the car window startled us. It was Eddie and Georgie and George, three boys we went to school with. "They're in Alton," Eddie said. "The Beatles are in Alton." Alton, Missouri, that is. Some number of miles from where we were at the moment. "We're going to meet them," Eddie said. And then he said the words that still haunt me 50 years later. "You should come with us." 2 years earlier, my parents had made a decision that I saw with a degree of angst that only 14-year-olds have at their disposal. They were leaving the Arkansas Delta, leaving Marianna, the town where I had grown up, the town where I thought all my friends, and more dramatically, my entire life would be left behind. We were moving to Cherokee Village, a retirement development in north central Arkansas. Imagine the excitement of a young teenager to spend her prime years in Codgerville. Actually, I was familiar with Cherokee Village outside Hardy. Since my grandmother had moved there and built a house on the lake, my family had spent their summer vacations with her. It was there where I got to know my Yankee cousins and where I saw my future as a recreational drinker, spending the evenings in a circle on the floor with the older cousins playing chugging games. I was returning from an exciting train trip to Milwaukee to see a girlfriend when I heard the news. Mother met me at the train station in Memphis and dropped the bomb. Daddy was closing his corner grocery store in Marianna and beginning a new job with Cherokee Village Incorporated. Actually, it would be a year before I would move. They stashed me with my older sister and her family for a year. Then, the summer after my 15th birthday, I moved to Cherokee Village. I was to enroll at the local school that fall, Hardy Har Har High, as we called it. By no means was Marianna High School large, but at Hardy that year, the senior class numbered 26. The culture shock began to wear off soon, though, and I realized that I was no longer in the shadow of my older brother and sister. My beautiful sister, who sang like an angel, my popular brother, who would have nothing to do with his pudgy little sister. At Hardy High, I was the new girl. I had shed the baby fat and was starting to fit in. As my life changed, the world of music changed. Having grown up near the crossroads, I was well schooled in the blues. Then came the Beatles, who on their 1964 U.S. tour disembarked and discombobulated most young girls my age. It was the time of life when love songs speak directly to you. My boyfriend, though imaginary at the time, did want to hold my hand. He loved me. Yeah. I had been a big Elvis fan, but there was only one of him. The Beatles, though, were a smorgasbord of sex symbols. Only a few girls went for Ringo, but then drummers often get the short end of the stick. The shrinking violets liked George. Me, I ran with the crowd and preferred the pretty boy, Paul. But John had that irreverent, quirky sense of humor. Such a difficult choice for a fan. The best radio station we could pick up out of the hills was WLS from Chicago. They sponsored a contest for fans to write the word Beatles on household objects and send them to the radio station. For two full weeks, I spent my lunch break writing Beatles around and around a new stick of blackboard chalk, determined to mark my place in radio history. As I neared the finishing lines, the chalk rolled off the desk and shattered into dust. It was just as well. My idea paled in comparison to the kid who had written Beatles 200 times on a piece of sliced cheese. Probably the most rabid of fans at my high school were Eddie and George and Georgie. They all wore their hair long like the Beatles, or at least what we considered long back then. They had a band, of course. And of course, they were the ones who begged us to go with them to Alton that night on what I was sure was a fool's errand. I had always prided myself in the fact that no one had ever been able to send me on a snipe hunt. And when I worked in Daddy's grocery, I never fell for those Prince Albert in a can jokes. You guys are crazy, I told them. The Beatles aren't going to be in some little jerkwater town in Missouri. Much to the disappointment of my more adventurous date, I said no. The next week at school, Eddie and Georgie and George did exactly what I expected them to do. They came to class crowing about having met the Beatles. Sure, I said. Sure, everyone said. No one believed them. Or at least not until later when we saw the Life magazine spread. Eddie laid the magazine open on my school desk. There was a double-page photo of the mop tops looking laid back and Americanized. The pictures, the article said, had been taken recently at a ranch in, that's right, Alton, Missouri. On September 18, 1964, the Beatles finished a concert at Memorial Coliseum in Dallas, Texas, and immediately boarded a plane owned and operated by Reed Pigman. The plane made a brief stop in Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, giving that tiny town a place in modern music history. Then Pigman took them to his ranch in Alton. There were reports of teenagers climbing the 6-foot chain link fence and running across the pasture to see the Beatles. A few stayed around in the yard until evening, until Pigman came out and politely said the Beatles were not going to make an appearance, so they might as well go home. That's what Eddie and Georgie and George said they did, scale the fence, but they said they actually met the Beatles. Now, that doesn't mean they did, but to this day, 50 years later, I wonder, what if I had actually met John, Paul, George, and Ringo that night? Would I have kept my 16-year-old composure or dissolved into a screaming preteen? Would I have sung along with Paul or engaged Ringo in a deep, meaningful discussion on the meaning of life? Perhaps I would have caught John's eye, and it would have been me, not Yoko, to be reviled for life as the one who broke up the Beatles. Oh, well. I can't go back and change fate. I guess I'll just have to let it be.
Catherine Schultz teaches journalism at the University of Arkansas Fayetteville. She just learned last week that she will be honored in July by the Arkansas Press Association as Journalism Educator of the Year. Next, Anne Gordon Perry doesn't realize it, but she has a front seat to history in Beatlemania.
It was 1966. I was 14 years old, and me, my friend Nancy, and my two younger siblings were on our way to see the Beatles live in concert. As we got out of the taxi and started walking up the sidewalk to the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, the first thing I noticed was the rows of policemen lined up, anticipating a rowdy night by the anti-Beatles protesters. This was after John's "We are bigger than Jesus" comment, which had not gone over so well in the South. The Memphis City Council almost canceled the two shows that day. Rather than have municipal facilities be used as a forum to ridicule anyone's religion, the Ku Klux Klan apparently nailed a Beatles album to a wooden cross, vowing vengeance. And conservative groups staged public burnings of Beatle records. Their version of Beatlemania wasn't the same as ours. Maybe we should call it Beatlemania. Despite the controversy, an afternoon crowd of around 10,000 showed up, with an evening crowd of over 12,500. Still, there were empty seats at both performances. I wonder now whether it was hard for my mom to leave us there, although she was used to tense public situations, being an activist in the civil rights and peace movements and all. We made it into the door, and we were ushered to our seats, and as I looked around, I saw almost all teenage girls in the audience, and quite a few signs declaring love for the band or for individual Beatles. I had to sit on my hands for the excruciatingly long wait for the show to begin. 2 years earlier, on February 9th, 1964, the night that changed America when the Beatles performed on the Ed Sullivan Show, was my 12th birthday. I watched the TV along with a record number of Americans, breathlessly. After the first taste of pure passion and paradise, Beatlemania was born and had us suddenly in its grip. There was no cure, only the addictive need for more sightings of the Beatles and the audio sensation of their music. Each of us preteen and teenage girls knew that all my loving was meant just for us. I Want to Hold Your Hand proved it too, along with I Want to Be Your Man and other songs that engendered responses in us that included swooning, screaming, and endlessly debating about which Beatle was cutest. I could never decide which one I was in love with most deeply, but generally, it was Paul. This was no mere crush, but a deep love affair that defied and transcended past experience, logic, and reason. If you had Beatlemania, you were just infected with an uncontrollable emotional condition that was beyond anything else in the known universe. During the next year and a half, I listened to any music I could find of theirs. Where were the iPods and the smartphones back then? Meet the Beatles was a coveted album, played again and again. And though shy, I am sure I spent time kissing the faces of the Fabulous Four on the record jacket. And then, in 1966, it happened. The Beatles scheduled their first appearance for that tour in the South, in Memphis. My best friend, Nancy Bass, and I begged our parents to let us go. Her father said he would take us, as long as we paid for the tickets ourselves. Tickets were $5.50. A bit of a stretch for us. As it turned out, her father had business that kept him from driving us over. So he hired a pilot friend to fly us in his Beechcraft Bonanza. It was astonishing to be going to our first rock concert in a private plane. To make myself beautiful for the band, I rolled my hair on orange juice cans during the plane ride. A particular torture to sleep on, but well worth any discomfort on this occasion. I was tingling with anticipation as I paired those empty juice cans with the bobby pins to create that 60s hairdo. Luckily, I remembered to take them out before disembarking from the plane. My mom escorted the four of us on the plane ride from Little Rock to Memphis. When we landed, we took a taxi, which was also unusual for us, to an elegant top-of-a-building restaurant. Then Mom dropped us off at the concert. For her, seeing the Beatles wasn't worth listening to all the screaming. But later she was sorry she couldn't say she had been there. My hands were practically numb as I sat on them, waiting for the show to start. The opening band was The Circle singing Red Rubber Ball. My anticipation was worse than waiting for Christmas morning. When the Beatles came out on the stage, I thought I might faint. But as soon as the music began, I started screaming like mad. I didn't think I would scream. It wasn't logical to interrupt the music, but it seemed the most natural response. We waved, we swooned. In short, we were completely overtaken by the presence of our heroes on stage. Ringo was elevated with his drum set, I remember, while the other three stood on the stage itself. I did not throw my underpants up onto the stage. But I remember seeing some hurling panties landing somewhere near the band. What was it about their music or the times that led to such wild abandon? We could hardly tear ourselves away at the end. I wanted to go to the stage door and actually see them face to face, but I would have been terribly shy and tongue-tied in that scenario, so I could only imagine what it might be like to gaze up at one of them up close. Luckily, in my euphoria, I didn't lose my friend or siblings in the crowd. I had no way of knowing that years later I would tell my college students about it, and they would be jealous. That decades later I would go to a Ringo concert in Little Rock, and then to a highly produced Paul McCartney concert in Dallas, and that the individual Beatles would be a bit more sedate but still have their original talent and charm. But in 1966 in Memphis, as we left the Coliseum, then boarded the plane to home, the spark of true love had ignited a passion that would be more potent than any crush or love affair. Don't even suggest it was infatuation. That night, my world changed from an ordinary life to one of intoxicating splendor.
Ann Gordon Perry, who grew up in Little Rock, teaches at the Art Institute of Dallas. She enjoys experiences that connect random members of the human race together. In our final story of the night, Jan Hamlet's inner teenager almost misses her chance in Since I Saw Him Standing There.
Is Paul there? Paul who? Paul McCartney. No, he's not here. What a thrill it was to be standing there at the gate of the London home of Sir Paul with my music professor husband and his British invasion class. I had walked reverently over to inspect the intercom. Did it really work? Let's find out, said a student. Boldly, he had simply pushed the button. At 54, how could I suddenly be back inside my 14-year-old head, marveling that we had just communicated with someone in there, someone who actually saw him every day? Unbelievable, thrilling, almost up there with hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand for the very first time or seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's Really Big Shoe. In 1964, the hardest decision I had was choosing my favorite Beatle. It had to be well thought out. You couldn't just choose willy-nilly, and you certainly couldn't be wishy-washy. You were known for your signature Beatle, so it was crucial to get it right. Sadly, I had to rule out John. He was a bit too intellectual. I just wasn't there yet. And George, with his mysterious, dark, good looks, would have appealed more to an older me. I considered at length choosing Ringo because of his down-to-earth sweet charm and his oh-so-innocent smile. Excruciatingly, it was Paul who made the final cut and became, forever and always, my favorite Beatle. I loved everything about him. The innocent sexiness of his eyes, the adorable shape of his mouth, and the special way his mop top moved when he shook his head and sang, "Woo!" Since I saw her standing there. And, oh yeah, his talent. Wow, at 54, standing at that gate, I was happy that I could still feel the same enthusiasm I had at 14. However, I wondered whether I might be exhibiting a disturbing lack of maturity, as I was definitely still starstruck. Was it ridiculous at my age to be so easily spirited away? The answer would arrive 5 years later, not in London, but in Dallas. In 2009, I was thrilled to learn that Paul McCartney would be in concert August 19th at Cowboy Stadium. But oh my, ticket prices. Once again, in teenage mode, I rationalized, this can be Christmas, birthday, Valentine's, and whatever else comes up. After the initial mandatory hesitation demanded by my husband's frugal nature, he agreed that we should go. Anticipation rose with the temperature. After 45 years, I would finally see Paul. The big day arrived with its heat and humidity, yet I had never felt cooler. I wanted to arrive with time to spare, with no rushing or traffic delays or parking issues. For once, I was determined to be early. Heading into the city, I had a phone conversation with our Dallasite daughter, who listened to my chatter, but then started questioning us about our route. I told her, as Kurt nodded agreement, "Oh, we know how to get there." "Okay," she responded, in that familiar tone a parent uses with a know-it-all teenager. "Oh, we knew how to get there, all right. We knew how to get to where the Dallas Cowboys played every single home game, in Irving." As we entered the area of the interstate where exit signs should have been, we wondered what was up. Where was the famous stadium? We were puzzled, and I began to get nervous. You see, having dumped America's team, when they dumped Tom Landry, we had not kept up to speed on the construction of their new home. What is it the realtors say? That all-important factor? Location, location, location. I must have blocked out some of the more traumatizing details of our aimless driving, but I do remember the miracle of my husband finally pulling into a convenience store and asking where we were and how on God's green earth were we supposed to get to Cowboys Stadium. The reply, Cowboys Stadium is in Arlington. Of course, the Irving Stadium was Texas Stadium. The answer to Shakespeare's question, what's in a name, is a lot. Especially if the lot is in another city. As we headed that way, I was frantic. How could this happen? What were we thinking? Would we make it? OMG! As we arrived in Arlington, we breathed easier until we saw the traffic at a standstill. You see, in close proximity to the new Cowboys Stadium was Rangers Stadium. Who were these people going to watch baseball? With Sir Paul right next door. Were they mad? In fact, it was I who was mad, defined as insane, hysterical. In agony, I threw my head back and moaned, "We are going to miss Paul. We are right here, and we are going to miss him." Desperate, I was thinking about making a run for it. But at that very moment, destiny took pity on me. Turning a corner, we saw Jerry's house, soon to be rocking, with or without us. Stop, go, repeat. Then a breakthrough. We were in the parking lot. With only minutes to spare, we made our way into entry F and through the wheelchairs lined up around the top of Blue 11. But could we find our seats? It was dark, and neither of us had brought reading glasses. Our rescuer, a nice lady in a Keep Austin Weird t-shirt, read our seat numbers, and we were in. Mesmerized, I watched as my favorite Beatle removed his black Nehru jacket after driving my car, saying, "That's the only wardrobe change of the evening." In his white shirt and red suspenders, he entertained us magnificently with his playful gait and charming mannerisms, his high energy mix of old and new, and that endearing accent, all accompanied by that twinkle in his crinkly boyish eyes. Moving easily from the solo acoustic yesterday to the pyrotechnics of Live and Let Die, and delivering two encores at 67, he still had it, and he still had me. This year, I will turn 64, and besides wondering, will you still feed me? I am amazed that only yesterday, I was 14, when all my troubles seemed so far away. Recently, watching a video of My Love from that 09 concert, I felt a tingle in my spine. Must be that pinched nerve, I thought. Then, popping up right underneath the ever-youthful Paul was an ad for Medicare Supplemental Insurance. What? How could it be that I was their target audience? Thinking about maturity, I reflected on my question. The answer is no. It is not ridiculous to be a bit starstruck, gaga, or immature. I am grateful to Sir Paul for reminding me of that magical mystery tour that occasionally transports me back 50 years to a place where I can feel 14 again. These flashbacks help me remember that the spirit never ages. I have kept this in mind for a long, long time, at least since, since I saw him standing there.
Jan Hamlet is a grateful, not dead yet boomer chick who lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, with one husband and one cat who are both very tolerant. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Preachers said I only wanted to say a wondrous song about the judgment day, telling us how rock and roll will never stay. And all the sinners, the lovers, and the concubines were living on peace and a bottle of wine. And me and the boys are too scared to do anything. Shouted out, brother, sing that hillside tune. Shouted out, sister, why you sitting in your room? They're living in one accord. They're living by the spirit and they're dying by the soul. Contribution in the gold-plated plate. God bless us all for heaven's sakes. I'll say a long prayer tonight, and I hope it takes. Shout it out, brother. Sing that hillside tune. Shout it out, sister. Why you sitting in your upper room? They're living in one accord. They're living by the spirit and they're dying by the soul. They're dying by the soul. And they're dying by the soul. Said I only wanted to say a wondrous song about the judgment day, telling us how rock and roll will never stay.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. list. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.